It's only Tuesday, and so far it's not a great week to be a top prosecutor in Pennsylvania. Something in the courthouse water? I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. We'll start off with Philadelphia District Attorney Seth Williams, who's released some financial disclosure documents detailing tens of thousands of dollars in gifts. As WHYY's Bobby Allen reports, it comes 1 year after reports indicating that the FBI and IRS were examining how he and his campaign have been moving money around.
Williams filed a 34-page document detailing gifts he received over 6 years. It totals $160,000, including a free $45,000 roof repair job, as well as trips to Key West and Thailand. Williams recently hired consultants to help him, quote, professionalize his campaign finances.
It seems as though as they went through the books, they found a whole bunch of stuff that was not reported when it should have been, and now it's all coming out at one time.
Pat Christmas with the Watchdog Group Committee of 70 says disclosing gifts as an office holder is the law, and there are penalties for not doing so.
Gifts and influence are going to be always surrounding our public officials, but the prompt and constant disclosure of the stuff is what's critical.
On the city level, public officials could face up to a $1,000 civil fine per undisclosed gift. And on the state level, penalties can be even stiffer. Robert Caruso heads the State Ethics Commission.
If a public official didn't file a form as prescribed by the law, the public official then could be penalized up to the amount of their compensation for holding the position.
For Seth Williams, that would be $175,000, his annual salary. Williams attorney Sam Stretton says he's in talks with city and state officials to settle the apparent violations.
He has now correctly amended the forms, and he's acting in good faith, and that's the important thing.
Among the gifts Williams listed were two all-access Eagles tickets right on the sidelines for 5 seasons. What did they add up to? Williams' report said no face value. The FBI, meanwhile, has not commented on its ongoing investigation of Williams, and it's unclear if Williams' new financial disclosures are at all connected. Williams is seeking a third term as district attorney next year. He's made a name for himself in part for prosecuting public officials who failed to disclose gifts, including taking up a sting operation that the Attorney General's office had chosen not to pursue. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
Moving on now to Pennsylvania Attorney General Kathleen Kane, who's planning to appeal her guilty verdict, though she's pledged to step down by the end of the day tomorrow. Bruce Castor, a Republican former Montgomery County District Attorney who ran unsuccessfully for Attorney General in 2004, says he'll take the oath privately tomorrow. Meanwhile, a jury convicted Kane of 9 criminal charges, including perjury and conspiracy, last night. Her attorney, Gerald Chargell, would not say on what grounds he'd appeal, but Kane was, quote, denied the opportunity to mount a full defense.
We, and those of you who are familiar, and I think that's all of you, are familiar with the history of this case, the so-called porn gate. We believe that our defense was compromised, and we will fight that till the end.
Prior to the trial, a common pleas judge ruled Kane's attorneys could not bring up her claim that she was being vindictively prosecuted because she released information about pornographic emails traded among prominent attorneys and judges. Hillary Clinton has done plenty of campaign appearances and advertising in Pennsylvania since the conventions this summer. She was in West Philadelphia this afternoon, and her focus this time was on grassroots work, including voter registration. WHYY senior reporter Dave Davies was there, and he reports that the Trump campaign is struggling to keep up with the Democrats' field organization in this battleground state.
One of the storylines of the campaign so far is that Trump's state organizations have been thin to non-existent, while the Clinton campaign has been hiring staff and planting field offices all around battleground states like Pennsylvania. Philadelphia is a key area for Clinton, and she drew several hundred people to the gym at West Philadelphia High School for a rally, which ended with a call to mobilize.
So let me thank you for being out here on a hot August afternoon at this beautiful high school. And let me ask you to be sure to register to canvass to be part of this campaign.
She said the polls look good for her now, but she expects a battle and wants all her supporters to pitch in.
So, my friends, let's go to work. and let's build the future that America deserves. Thank you, and God bless you.
After the exhortations, the route out of the gym was lined with staff encouraging everyone to make a left turn into a room with tables and chairs where volunteers would be trained for canvassing. A few dozen took up the offer. One of them was Roe Breslin of South Philadelphia, a retired accountant who's agreed to become what the campaign calls a fall fellow, which she says is some pretty heavy-duty volunteer work.
They're looking for people to actively register voters in, like, not just Pennsylvania, but in other states, do door-to-door canvassing, work phone banks. It's pretty intensive. You commit to at least 15 hours a week.
That's 15 hours every week until the election. The Clinton campaign has regularly announced field office openings, and they say now there are more than three dozen across the state. What about the Trump campaign? It's only in recent weeks that the campaign's had someone in Pennsylvania who could talk with reporters on the record. That's senior advisor David Urban, who says, like the Clinton campaign, the Trump organization is swarming across the state. He was asked if he could be more specific.
I can be specific, but I choose not to be specific. I know we have enough offices, manpower, resources, energy to do what we need to do to contest every ward, every precinct, not just in Philadelphia, but Pennsylvania statewide.
Calls to Republicans suggest that Trump field offices aren't everywhere yet. One is expected to open soon in Conshohocken. Lee Stover's an active Trump supporter who chairs the Northampton County Republican Party. She says the campaign expects to have an office open in the Lehigh Valley in the next few days.
Just got a call yesterday that they were zeroing in on a property that they were going to be leasing. And we've been using our county headquarters for volunteers to come in and do stuff for Trump. We've been doing door-to-door every Saturday in large groups.
Stover says she's seeing plenty of energy for Trump. Urban says there's a clear enthusiasm gap in the campaign, with Trump still drawing huge crowds. After all, he didn't have an extensive organization in the primary campaign either, and managed to beat just about everyone's expectations. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
Donald Trump trails Hillary Clinton by over 9 points in an average of 6 recent Pennsylvania polls. Some political analysts say the Republicans' odds of winning the state don't look great. But as Katie Meyer reports, the way Trump sees it, there's only one conceivable way he could lose the Commonwealth, and that's if the other side cheats.
At a rally in Altoona Friday, Trump suggested there was a good chance voter fraud could come into play in November.
The only way we can lose, in my opinion, I really mean this, Pennsylvania, is if cheating goes on. I really believe it.
The GOP candidate then took his theory a step further, calling on his supporters to make sure no funny business happens at the polls.
We have to call up law enforcement, and we have to have the sheriffs and the police chiefs and everybody watching.
Jack Treadway, a former political science professor and author of a book on Pennsylvania elections, says with those remarks, Trump crossed a line.
He really does insult voters in the state, this notion that people are voting. You know, I want to make sure nobody votes 10 times. Well, nobody can vote 10 times. I mean, you risk going to prison for one thing, but I mean, that's just, it's not possible, and there's no evidence that it occurs.
Treadway says there have been allegations of voter fraud in Pennsylvania in the past, but nothing of significance in recent history. The Department of State, which oversees elections, released a statement saying it's confident that the November election will meet the high standards of accuracy and fairness that have marked Commonwealth elections in the past. Election officials in various counties corroborated the statement. One of them, Jerry Fieser, director of the Dauphin County Bureau of Voter Registration and Elections, says his district follows very specific protocols to prevent inaccuracies.
Our process rests on well-trained election workers. We conduct training sessions before each election. Many of the people who have worked the polls have worked them for decades. And anybody who is a first-time poll worker will come to a training session before we assign them to an election district.
Similar protocols are followed across the state, though they do vary by district. Mark Wallasek, division manager for the Allegheny County Board of Elections, says he's not worried about fraud either. He notes under state law, it's common practice to have poll watchers. Clinton will almost certainly have them in November as well.
Well, under the election code, in November elections, a candidate has the right to appoint 2 watchers in every election district in which he or she is a candidate. And political parties are entitled to appoint 3 watchers.
Certified poll watchers can keep tabs on voters and alert officials if they think fraud's taking place, but they can't interact directly with or intimidate voters. Treadway says Trump's comments, however, do have the potential to incite more extreme action from supporters, potentially beyond the bounds of state law regarding poll watchers.
He has a lot of followers who believe these things, who are convinced that the deck is stacked against them, that the media, party regulars, other people are out to get them. And this just feeds into that, which creates the potential for somebody doing something, because in effect he's giving his blessing to that.
Treadway notes he doesn't think Trump's specifically advocating people break the law, but he says the GOP candidate's creating an atmosphere that could make it happen. The Trump campaign did not respond to a request for comment. Katie Meyer in Harrisburg.
Still ahead this evening.
You have to practice writing, and I think songwriters and writers in general a lot of times think that they're just supposed to have a natural gift and then just do it from the first page on.
New Orleans singer-songwriter Anders Osborne. I'll speak with him when NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY. Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. Frustration, suspicion, and anger are common themes among participants in the public comment process regarding the proposed 119-mile-long natural gas PennEast pipeline from Pennsylvania to New Jersey. Joining me to follow the flow is State Impact Pennsylvania reporter John Hurdle. John, welcome to NewsWorks Tonight.
Hi, Dave.
For starters, tell us about this PennEast pipeline.
Well, the PennEast pipeline is planned to take natural gas from Luzerne County, Pennsylvania, into central New Jersey. It's going to be about 120 miles, and it's going through a number of Pennsylvania and New Jersey counties.
And toward that end, it has to come up to muster, according to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. And they held these meetings starting last night. Apparently, you were in Jim Thorpe.
Yes, indeed, I was. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission has to approve interstate pipelines, and that's why they're involved in this project. And to that end, they are conducting a series of public meetings in both states at the moment, in which they're seeking public comment on something called the Draft Environmental Impact Statement. And that is a document that FERC published back in July, which contains its assessment of the environmental impact that this project, if it's implemented, would have on the natural environment.
You used the term public comment period, but it wasn't very public.
Well, that's right. That's what critics said, that it wasn't very public. And in fact, the only people who were allowed to attend the testimony were the individuals who were themselves giving the testimony. And I spoke with one of the attendees at this meeting, a gentleman called Mark Zakutansky, who belonged to the Appalachian Mountain Club. He was concerned about the environmental damage that he claims will be wrought by this pipeline project. And he was concerned about the format of the meeting. He said that it wasn't what he had expected when he showed up to the meeting.
These meetings have traditionally taken place in a more public format where people can hear other citizen comments. The more private nature of this meeting is not exactly what we had in mind. We feel the public has every right to hear each other's testimony.
Did the Regulatory Commission have a response when questioned about why they chose this format?
Yes, they did. I spoke with Alisa Likens, who was a senior official with FERC, who was present at the meeting. She said in the past, FERC has conducted more conventional public meetings. And she said that in one particular meeting, around about 300 people showed up. The intent for the new format was that people would be able to express their views in a more controlled way.
When we did our scoping meetings, we had 300 people speak and we ran out of time. So this was a way to be able to hear people and get everyone's heard, comments heard over the course of the evening.
When you referred to 300 participants earlier, that implies a rather robust response. What's the nature of some of these complaints about the proposed project?
Well, one of the complaints at the moment is relates to eminent domain, the legal process by which a pipeline company may be able to assert its rights to to build a pipeline on private land. Some critics of this project are also concerned that the natural gas that would be carried in the pipeline would be destined for export, and they feel that this would not be good justification for building the pipeline with all of the environmental risks that come with it, as they see it.
Was the commission able to offer some reassurance on that specific point about where that gas was destined?
They were not. The commission stressed that they were very much in a listening mode, and they did not give any response or any reaction to any of the specific concerns that were expressed by the members of the public.
And then if the project gets a green light from the EIS, then what?
Then construction will begin.
John, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
You're welcome, Dave.
State Impact Pennsylvania reporter John Hurdle. Acclaimed songwriter Anders Osborne has penned hits for country star Tim McGraw and blues artist Keb Moe. Decades into his prolific performing career, the singer and guitarist will showcase his new album, Flower Box, when he brings his touring band to Delaware this evening and then on to New Jersey tomorrow night. I visited with the New Orleans native on his tour bus this past weekend, where conversation quickly turned to the creative writing process.
What I do every day, and I have this, I call it the memo demo, and then here's where I put all the songs. I don't remember most of this stuff that I come up with. So I'll go back and I'll go, let's see, what was this thing? Okay, I remember that, cool. And you know, so it can be 40 seconds. Sometimes the whole song comes. So what has happened is the production has gone from maybe 30 to 50 a year to 150, 200 songs a year, because it's always moving.
It's so fabulous.
It's ridiculous is what it is. It doesn't mean everything is great, it goes on records, but it's, oh, so this is what I'm doing. Rather than going to a room, sitting by a thing, blah, blah, blah. Now you've already killed 35 minutes prepping and coffee and looking the part of a poet. That's all gone now. You just go for it. And then Spotify can take the money.
Well, so since you broached the topic, what is the music model anymore?
You can do whatever you want today, but if you want to look at the business model of it, you have to think of your personal relationship with what you're doing, which is, in my case, it would be me and God and making songs. Very simple meat and potatoes, nothing. I'm not Mozart. There's no highfalutin kind of stuff going on. I'm just writing.
You are, as you know, being modest in the moment, because that's so difficult for so many artists, and the attraction for so many is that rawness, that emotional transparency, as it were. Where do you draw the line of what to reveal?
I draw the line when to perform the songs, not what to write. The writing part and the making of it, that has to happen for reasons I don't know, but that has to happen. But if you start performing some of those songs, you know, when people ask me to over and over, I think it'll lose some of its validity.
Seem to be, if not in a renaissance, this is like a fountain of creativity. Do you ever wonder, am I going to get writer's block?
Knock on wood, I don't think there's such a thing as a writer's block anymore. But I allow myself to not finish songs. They don't all have to be finished. They don't all have to be good. But it's more like you have to practice writing. And I think songwriters and writers in general a lot of times think that they're just supposed to have a natural gift and then just do it from the first page on. And that's, oh, he's so talented or she's so brilliant. Well, that takes decades of honing your craft, right? So you have to study other people that are better than you. You have to emulate that. Then you have to teach some of your peer group as well. You have the people that are not as good. So you have to have this balance of everything. And then you just do it every single day. So I usually try to tell people that ask me about writing, make sure you just write all the time. Even if it's one line, one word, one melody, that doesn't have to lead to a song. That's practicing. That's stretching your fingers.
What's the balance for you between a lyric and then deciding to put music to it or vice versa?
Music comes first
90% of the time, but there's usually a line or a word that comes at the same time. And then I try to chip away at the line and see if there's something there that means something different. That's usually where it goes. And if it opens up, it comes pretty fast.
Make me a captain. Stop chasing that fool's gold.
We've touched on songwriting and performance and recording, and you also enjoy producing. You seem to be immersed in every part of the process.
Yeah, it's fun. It's more of a conductor role where you can listen to everything, and if you slow the tempo down a little bit, change the key. What if you go up to right where your voice cracks? Let me hear the song again. Whoa, that's amazing. You know, those kind of adjustments. That's fun to play with.
You know, we all have this, it's a human nature thing to put things in a box. So people will say, well, what kind of musician is Anders Osborne? Is it okay to say blues might be the biggest bucket that you draw from, or is not even that appropriate?
I think it's the smallest bucket.
Okay.
I get that a lot, though, but I think the blues part of that is the folk part. It's just folk music, simple chords, simple stuff.
You can't put it in a box.
What usually influences me the most is not so much specifically an artist that I listen to as what's the atmosphere I'm in.
Check out newsworks.org, where you can hear much more of our conversation, and Anders Osborne will play a previously unreleased song. That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader, with help today from Ty Johnson. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for Newsworks Tonight.